Let's go.
The most energetic, fit, and stress-resilient people on the planet practice daily habits to keep their hormones balanced, their gut healthy, and their muscles and mind strong. Welcome to That Fitness Couple. We're Mike and Corey Beth Lepowski, founders of Pure Physique.
This podcast is designed to provide you with everything we've discovered and continue to discover about nutrition, training, and lifestyle. Today, we all live hectic lives.
So we've made it our mission to make your fitness time efficient and to build you up. Hope you share and enjoy. Let's dive into today's episode.
Let's go.
Today, we want to talk about how to get the benefits of living a primal lifestyle in a modern society. For most of us, the idea of primal living is not that appealing, and it might feel like a step backward. But there's no denying that modern living is definitely not contributing to our health in a positive way. And so today, it's all about finding the middle ground between two contradicting lifestyles.
I mean, I feel like in some ways, though, you actually would be okay living a primal lifestyle. I could see you with some flint and two rocks trying to start a fire so that you can cook the dinner that I just hunted for us.
Mike, you actually have no idea. And yes, I would be.
Yeah, I know. Well, first, we want to dive into just a little historical context around primal lifestyle. And I think the importance of this conversation is, especially today, if you're going down the carnivore rabbit hole, you are destined to hear about primal lifestyles or primal living. And, you know, there are people who take it from a carnivore diet to the extreme of trying to live their lives the way our ancestors did. And, you know, listen, while in some ways we can applaud that, like you said, I think it's personally a step backward. You know, we have technology, we have these advancements to improve our lives. And I'm not giving up, you know, some of these things. And I'm sure a lot of our listeners aren't either.
I think I was today years old when I was affirmed in how very different we are.
Oh, absolutely. Completely different. I mean, you talk about sometimes being bougie, but I think I'm more bougie than you are.
Definitely.
Well, that said, though, let's just, again, talk about the historical context of this. I mean, in the daily life and environment of early humans. So just starting off with their environment, I mean, they lived in very diverse landscapes. The early humans, they inhabited a variety of different areas, as we do today. Some lived in savannas, others forests, deserts, and ice-covered regions. And the vastly different climates influenced how they migrated, as well as what their particular survival strategies were. And we often hear about these hunter-gatherers. And the predominant lifestyle was that of hunter-gatherers almost no matter where you were. Men typically hunted animals using tools that were made from stone and bone and wood, while the women and children gathered fruits, nuts, and other edible plants. Now, although the diet was highly dependent on the environment in the region, it generally consisted of a high proportion of animal protein and fat, with, hear this, seasonal fruits, vegetables, nuts, and seeds. What's so important about this that people lose sight of when they hear about primal living or trying to live primal today is the fact that the gathering part was very specific to the season. And these were not the same fruits and vegetables that we consume today.
Well, they are definitely not the same fruits and vegetables we consume today. And what I want to do is actually take a quick tangent into 13 man-made vegetables and fruits. And this really comes off the heels of having purchased organic apples for the clients in our studio for a teacher appreciation day back in November of 2023. And two of those apples are still in our fridge, completely intact, filming this now in May of 2024. So I don't know about you, but an apple that hangs around for 6+ months is not a very natural apple to me.
No, I mean, that's actually terrifying. I didn't even realize we had those in there.
They're the green apples in the back that no one's touched.
Well, that's because I don't go looking for apples
at this point. At this point, it's a science experiment. But so here's the deal. There's a process of selection and crossbreeding that humans use to create fruits and vegetables. And yes, they create them. And in fact, many of the popular fruits and vegetables today are indeed man-made. Now, they're man-made, obviously, to be tasty and delicious, but they're also designed to survive in heat, cold, and drought better than their natural counterparts. So let's go through these 13 real quick. And the first is broccoli. Yeah, you didn't realize that thing that your mom told you to eat every dinner time was completely a man-made vegetable. Now, it's a newer member of the brassica family. which comes from cabbage. It includes some other vegetables, including sprouts and kale and Brussels. And broccoli is actually a descendant of cabbage by the process of selective breeding, which leads us to our second, which is cauliflower. Cauliflower is included in that as well, also a descendant of cabbage. Crazy, right? So corn is third, and corn is a hybrid. In actuality, the origins of corn are unknown, but the corn and the popcorn that we are familiar with today are not what we were eating 2,000 years ago. Fourth up is bananas. This actually originated, and I'm totally going to butcher it. It's a cross between the Musa acuminata and the Musa balbiciana. These two forms of banana were not very edible because they had too many seeds. Kind of crazy, right? Now, the other types of bananas were actually seedless. They were small and fleshy, but they were very tough, making it hard to eat. So crossbreeding these two enabled us to have these big, giant, non-seedy, fleshy bananas that are sweet that we eat today. Did you know that?
Well, not only that, I was going to say, you actually did pretty good on that. I mean, I know you said you were going to butcher it, but I'm actually pretty impressed. I think I missed everything you just said because I'm trying to rehearse those two words that you just said.
Fifth, carrots. So generally we know carrots as being orange in color. They were actually originally found in the Middle East, Afghanistan, and Iran, even in Central Asia, but they were very different. They were very thin. They were purple or white in color. And I think we feel very fancy when we go to Trader Joe's today and we can get tri-colored carrots. In fact, we're actually getting the original color of carrots. Now, the orange color actually comes from beta carotene, which gives it its vitamin A content. But beta carotene is not present in any other vegetables, but it is found in pumpkins. So even these colors have been bred by farmers, whether it's intentional or unintentional, but carrots were not actually orange in the beginning. And also those carrot sticks or the, what are they called? Those little snappy things that they buy for the kids. They're like 99 cents for a bag.
Baby carrots?
Oh my gosh, baby carrots are not carrots at all. Just go to like How It's Made on YouTube and look at baby carrots. What they do is they take the scraps of carrots and they put them in a grinder and they're ground and round so that the edges become round. They're actually bleached and then color is reintroduced to those baby carrots to make them bright freaking orange. And so they look delicious.
Another reason why I don't eat any of this stuff.
Fifth is watermelon. So watermelon took about 200 years to cultivate and spread all across Europe and North America. Watermelons originated in the African deserts. They've even found paintings of watermelons as far as, you know, 4,000 years back in Egyptian tombs. Now, the ancestors of watermelon had a non-red flesh. It was actually a very pale color and, of course, many more seeds in it. And the biggest joke when summertime rolls around, when people go and buy their seedless watermelon, is that we are eating a genetically modified watermelon because if there's no seeds, how do we grow more watermelon? Kind of crazy. All right, next is apples. And we kind of mentioned this before, but all apples, now there's 7,500 varieties of apples. That's 7,500. They all originate from one main apple variety. That is the Malus sivirsir. I said that wrong. But even these apples, they're not very different from their ancestors in terms of how they look. They just weren't that big. Apples have become crossbred. Now we have Cosmic Crisp and we have all these different varieties, which are patented, by the way. If you check out, you know, the name of the apple, there's a registered trademark on it. And it's because we've crossbred the apple again and again and again to make it bigger and juicier and thicker and fleshier. And by the way, you're paying per pound for that apple. So the bigger the apple, the more the retailer is making when you buy your apple. Next up is peanuts. Now, peanuts actually were a crossbreed between some peanut variety in Bolivia and another in Peru. Now, while these two territories are actually very close to one another, peanuts had been around for about 10,000 years, which is kind of crazy, but they were cross-pollinated and voila, we have today's peanut. Next, eggplants. Now, this is a really interesting one. I mean, we think when we eat eggplant parmesan, we're being healthy. Am I wrong?
No, absolutely.
I used to feel that way all the time. I'm like, oh, I'm being healthy. I'm having eggplant. Now, eggplants are similar to eggs because they're round in shape and have that white color, which is how we actually get the name eggplant.
What white color?
The inside is fleshy white.
Got it. I'm thinking about the outside.
Eggplants as we know them are purple, but actually the early color of eggplant was yellow, and there were multiple shades of purple. They do come in various forms. Some are very long and skinny, others are fat, and some even globe-shaped. But again, the name comes from the similar look to the egg, which is why we call it
an eggplant. It's so interesting because now that I think about it, I've never seen an eggplant that wasn't cooked and soaked in marinara sauce. Just saying.
And fried.
That's why I have no idea what color it's supposed to be.
All right. Next is one that I think is going to be surprising to you, and that's oranges. So oranges were first grown and cultivated in southern China, and they were later brought all around the world by traders. So they crossed a mandarin and a pomelo. And these two fruits being crossbred resulted in the orange that we have today. That's incredibly tasty and does provide some vitamins and other necessities. All right, next, tomatoes. So tomatoes can actually be tracked all the way back to Mexico with the early Aztecs in 700 AD. The ancestors of the tomatoes were the Lycopersicon esculentum. I didn't do so good on that one. Basically, tomatoes became famous. They made their own way from westward to Italy. And now we see that tomatoes are used all over the world. And of course, the cultivation of them has also increased. You can buy them in a can, stewed tomatoes.
Tomato, tomato.
Last two here, we got strawberries. So in 1764 in France, Antoine Nicolas Deschenes bred the modern strawberry, and he bred female as well as the male strawberry. The male strawberry was the Fragaria machata, and the female strawberry was the Fragaria chiloinus, which resulted in beautiful strawberries. Did you know that there was a male and a female strawberry?
No, this stuff is like blowing my mind.
So France is well known for its cultivation of strawberries over the years. A lot of our strawberries do come from France, especially wild strawberries, which, by the way, are very teeny tiny in size. They look absolutely positively nothing like the Driscoll strawberries we buy in the supermarket that are as big as your palm. And so the other fun fact about strawberries is by cutting into one, you can look at how the outside is red, but the inside is white. And actually what's supposed to happen in natural ripening is the inside of the strawberry becomes red as well, or pink in color. When you cut in and it's just pure white or that white yellow color, that strawberry likely has been chemically ripened, which happens when our farmers spray to make the strawberry look ripe. But then you get home and you're disappointed because it's not so sweet. All right, last up is grapefruit. So grapefruit was first discovered over 300 years ago as Captain Shattuck from the West Indies was the first person to crossbreed the orange and the pomelo. So check this out. We took a mandarin and a pomelo to come up with oranges. Then we took that crossbred orange, we crossbred it with a pomelo again, and boom, we get grapefruit. Now, it's very tasty. It has a very unique citrus flavor, which spread all through Europe. It's also referred to, by the way, as the forbidden fruit due to its beautiful and very interesting taste. It's something that we use in different recipes. We want to add that tanginess. It does have some vitamin C in it. And there you are, 13 fruits and vegetables that were absolutely man-made and did not exist in nature until we started messing with them.
Wow. I mean, that was pretty extensive. No, I mean, listen, I think we can also take so many different things from that. Not only, you know, is it eye-opening how many of these fruits have been cultivated by man. I mean, these were not things that were necessarily growing on trees until we created the trees that could produce these fruits. But also, I just go back to what I had mentioned very early on, which is regions and seasons, in that, you know, you hear about where some of these things came from. And, you know, for that fruit to get from where it was to where we find it now today in our supermarket produce section, you know, there's got to be a lot that goes into making that happen. And we know what that a lot is, right? I mean, that is the treatment of these fruits. It's the refrigeration or the freezing of them as well as they transport them across continents and such. So maybe the way that these fruits, though, were being consumed back then, you know, I can't imagine that it was the same as what we have today.
I couldn't agree more. I mean, I remember when we did a nutrition course back in like 2014, and it was that the apple we eat today does not have anywhere near the nutrients that it had somewhere in the 1950s. So you just go back 75 years and there's a nutrient crop decrease, right? So we don't have in our soil what they had back then. There's a whole like a microbiome in our gut. Our soil has a microbiome. And so because of the speed at which we have to cultivate food, yeah, then you think about too, these fruits and vegetables grew at specific temperatures. So to be able to come over here and be grown here, again, you know, we can go to the extent to say like it's kind of unnatural and not so good, but I know how it feels just like many do when you go to the supermarket. Maybe we're a little before the season of that fruit and you buy something and that pear is like just not good. It's hard. It's not sweet. It's not ripe. It sucks, but we have to transport this fruit. We don't know where it's actually being grown all the time. I actually reached out to that manufacturer of the apple that's still in our refrigerator. And they gave me a list of like 58 different suppliers to call. And my response email was, do you really expect me to call 58 suppliers? Like, I don't have time to do this. Like, can you please just tell me where the apple came from? And they don't know. So there you have it. Well, let's move on. You know, when it comes to vegetables in particular, there were specific time-consuming processes to prepare these foods for consumption. And a lot of them were preserved so that they could have different fruits and vegetables in the off season. But that preservation process also helps in the digestion and the breaking down of them. Now, hunting for animals, regardless of environment or region, was always the primary focus. And I know you're going to get on board with this. It's everything else was supporting nutritional needs when meat was scarce. So we were not relying primarily on our salad bowls and our chia seed bowls and our whatever bowls we're eating. We were relying on animal meat for everything we needed.
I'm sure we'll get into this a little bit deeper shortly, but I just think it's very interesting that when we look at it today, the approach that we should be taking with regards to our nutrition is in many ways this primitive lifestyle where things are seasonal, where we are only needing it when we need it, and that we should be looking to get our food from these animal sources, which are, again, providing us with more bioavailable nutrients. However, the problem is today, meat is not scarce. You know, we can easily go down to the supermarket and get meat. We can go to our local butcher or farmer and get meat. So it just, all for me, it just begs the question, do we really need all of these other things when it comes to providing for our nutritional needs, when these other things such as meat are no longer scarce? I mean, I know that for us, the fast and quick answer is no, we don't need these other things. But this does get into the individualized questions of what are your preferences? And I know that for some people, having things that are tasty or different and providing that variety in their lives is what they're looking for. And maybe the nutritional component is not as important. But we'll get back to that in a little bit. When we weren't hunting or gathering, I mean, what our ancestors were doing is they were making tools to hunt and tools to gather and things to eat with and things to build with. And also socially, what was very different then is that they lived in these very small nomadic groups where they shared all the responsibilities of food gathering and preparing and caregiving and protection. So when we just look at that, I mean, that is so different, not just the fruit, not just the hunting and gathering part, but even the social aspect was very different.
And there's something to be said for that too. You know, I think that people that live the longest and are the healthiest do have that social component. And what I'll say is we are seeing a massive movement today back towards that. In fact, my sister and our brother-in-law sent pictures of a big community garden they're building with two other families down in Tennessee. And I think that it's beautiful that we are getting back to our roots in this way, because I think that when we see how our food is grown, where it comes from, how we can harvest our own food, I think there's just like a different, there's probably different nutrients. We can also control what goes on it. There's probably not pesticides that preserve apples for 6 months in your refrigerator. And I think energetically, we just have a fruit or vegetable that probably serves us at a higher level than some of the stuff you buy in the store.
Well, before we move on, just three more characteristics, though, of this primal lifestyle that people were living. One had to do with their physical activity. So they were constantly on the move. So they were hunting, they were going for long walks, they were running, they were climbing, and they were crawling. And unlike today, where exercise is structured, it's a scheduled part of our lives, their physical activities were integrated into their daily survival. And then we look at health and the different hazards that they had to contend with. You know, early humans were regularly exposed to the elements, which meant they had to develop a resilience to cold and to heat. and to these varying weather patterns. They also face threats from predators and other human groups. And then you get into the cultural and the spiritual beliefs. I mean, spiritually, they had many different beliefs and rituals, but all practiced some form of worship to a higher power. And all of these lifestyle components, as well as many others that we haven't even discussed or are beyond the scope of this conversation today, are what we would define as this primal lifestyle. So I think now is a good time to transition, and let's just start to contrast that with our modern lifestyle.
Hey, we hope you're enjoying our show and finding it valuable. If you could do us a quick favor, it would mean the world to us. Please take a moment to rate and review our podcast on your favorite platform. Your reviews help us reach more people and share our message. Plus, we'd love to hear your feedback. Thanks for being awesome and supporting us. Now, back to the show. So some of the challenges that we have today are that we sit at a desk. We don't have very hard work unless we choose that work, like exercise or do-it-yourself projects. Machines, well, they make things for us. They do a lot of things for us. We think about taking our clothes and putting them into a barrel that spins them and churns them. We don't have to wash our clothes. We put them in an automatic washer. We travel mostly by vehicle versus traveling by foot, and food gets delivered to our doorstep instead of us hunting it. We have little to no involvement in the preparation of our food. And we live around a lot more people, but we live far more self-centered lives. Society, it could be seen as spiritually dead, and we worship ideologies instead of God. Some people even worshiping themselves as becoming a god.
And what this basically adds up to are all of these problems that our modern society is suffering from. We have obesity, there's chronic stress, cancer, heart disease, diabetes, people living very unfulfilled lives. Because of all this, it's easy to understand why the promotion of a primal lifestyle is attractive. But the fact is, we don't live in primitive times, and turning back the clock isn't an option or a preferable one. So the question becomes, how can we mimic the physical and mental health outcomes of primal living? And that moves us into this question, or answering this question, of how we can adapt primal principles to today. And I think probably the best and easiest place to start would be with exercise. And if we think about what the primitive lifestyle looked like, I mean, we already explained how there was a lot of constant movement going on, and there was these times in which they were doing what we would consider today very high intensity exercise. What was that? That was hunting for their food or escaping from predators. And that did not happen frequently. For the most part, I think we can say that it was not a daily occurrence. And we know that hunting was something that took sometimes days for a group of men to go out and camp, and men would have to cover miles upon miles in order to hunt down their food, and then they would have to drag it back. And that is not easy work. So when we think about what we could be doing today, well, this is where the importance of high intensity exercise truly fits in. And we think about, what would that form of exercise look like? Well, it would look like resistance training. It would be going into the gym for a short period of time, but literally putting forth your maximum effort. For other people, it might be doing a high intensity interval training type of workout. It could be running sprints. And then on the days that we're not doing that, what are we doing? We're walking, we're moving, we're just staying active, but not engaging in this high intensity activity. And that right there is probably the easiest thing for most people to implement that would mimic that primal lifestyle.
It really is so simple. And I think back to our interview with Suzanne Alexander, who said that she crawls around her yard. And while I've tried to still envision what that would look like for me, and it's something that I have not come back to, I do think about when I was a kid, I'd crawl up the stairs, like, you know, like you kind of like hop up with like your hands and legs. There is something to that for balance and just, again, to use all sides of your brain, both sides. All right, let's move into diet. So in terms of the primal diet framework, it's focusing on meat and occasionally introducing plants and fruits, keeping in mind what we shared earlier about the ones that were man-made. Now, we really want to adopt that meat-centric diet in a sustainable, ethical, and healthy manner. So there are great small farms that you can support. I believe that every dollar we spend, especially on food or fitness, it's a vote for that type of business. So we can take the easy way out, so to speak, where we're going to a Walmart or you know, a big wholesaler and we're buying our ground beef there, or you can support a local farmer. And I think dollar for dollar, it's not that vastly different. And the quality you'll get, I think it's priceless.
I think this is also a good time to briefly discuss supplements, because people always feel a certain sort of way around supplements. And you will hear a lot of people on the carnivore side say, well, if you're just eating a carnivore diet, you don't need supplements. Or if you're just eating healthy in general, consuming whole foods. But I think we've gone through a lot already to explain how many of the modern foods that we have today are not even what they were 10, 20, 30, 100 years ago for sure. So I believe that there is a role here for supplementation in order to help provide our bodies with some of the things that we're not getting from our food. And even when we have these farms that are doing things the right way, we can't look past the fact that our environment, the external environment that those animals are living in, is not the same. So you can provide all the beautiful land. You can make sure that your crops are not being treated with glyphosate, but we don't know what's happening at the farm down the road. We know that glyphosate is in our air. In fact,
it's in our water.
Well, I was told that there is not a single human alive today that if they were tested for glyphosate, it wouldn't show up.
I believe it.
And that's just because it just floats around in the air. So I think when we start to take all of these things into consideration, this is why, you know, I'm definitely not anti-supplement. I think that they provide some great health benefits and can really fill that role, quote, supplement, where we might be missing out.
All right. I'm very pro-supplements. So I like that you sit on that side. That's moderate. I think that there's always a time and a place for them. And I think they're incredibly beneficial for our immune systems and our gut. I also just wanted to point to this diet piece that there's also a mindset shift we have to make. And this was actually a message that came in from a current client, one of our programs. And she said that she's concerned she's not getting what she needs in terms of vitamins and minerals, which is totally a legitimate concern, because when you're used to eating everything, because we're taught eat in moderation and eat everything, and then you limit, so to speak, your food groups, you have this mindset shift that you have to overcome. Now, I'm going to continue her message. She said, I'm concerned I'm not getting these vitamins and minerals since I'm not eating carbs. And I'm like, huh, this is interesting. So I called her right away. I'm like, this is not a message that I want to text back and forth. Let's have a conversation. Basically, what she shared is that she had eaten different carbs, including some bread, some Mexican food, rice, cookies, donuts, and Little Debbie's. That's a real comment by her. And, you know, rather than saying, well, you know, carbs are not essential for human life and all the things that we know, my question to her, and one that I ask you to pose to yourself, if maybe you're trying to have a hard time getting through this from a mindset perspective, is which vitamins and minerals specifically do then you think you're missing out on? And she laughed. I mean, she just went into a full-on belly laugh because she realized that there's no necessary vitamins or minerals from cookies or Little Debbie's or bread or anything like that. And so I wanted to throw that in there. I think it's important to encourage yourself, to challenge yourself, because I think oftentimes our brain seeks comfort. And when we're used to having a sandwich with slices of turkey, but the bread and the tomato and the lettuce and the cheese and everything else, is we have to ask ourselves, what minerals and vitamins am I seeking to get out of this? Realizing that cutting out these things that were actually creating gross inflammation in her body were not necessary. And since cutting, she's dropped 11 pounds of body weight. Her A1C has improved and her blood sugars become consistent. So amazing.
What's interesting about that too, though, is so many people have been conditioned to believe that all of their vitamins and minerals are going to come from these foods, which we know are very inflammatory foods. But how can you help yourself when you've been told all your life, you go into the supermarket and you see right there on the box, fortified with vitamin B, fortified with vitamin A or C. I mean, you pick the letter out of the alphabet and put vitamin in front of it and put it on a box, and people really believe that they're getting that from it. But we know that what they're being provided is synthetic and it's not bioavailable and your body's not absorbing it. So I can totally understand why she's coming from that point of view, but I think it's important that people do start to learn and understand that, listen, the healthiest food that you're going to eat is going to be that which comes from the earth, whether that be the animals or the plants, I'm going to say, or the fruits, but never Little Debbie's, right?
Or Lucky Charms, because those I think have 21 vitamins and minerals also. All right, let's move on to intermittent fasting.
All right. Well, this is just interesting because, again, we've heard of fasting. We've talked about fasting. And when we take it back to its historical basis, people fasted for periods of time. Sometimes it was for religious reasons. Other times it was because there was just simply no food available. As we said, they hunted and they gathered their food. And when they were eating those fruits and vegetables that they prepared, particularly so that they could be consumed, it was during these times of famine. It was during these times in which there was no animal available. And so people were accustomed to either eating small amounts of food and fasting the rest of the time, or just fasting because there was no food available. And today, I mean, we can easily mimic this in many different ways, probably the most popular of which is intermittent fasting, which would be your 16-8 method, or again, you can pick the timing, but having those extended periods of time where we are intentionally abstaining from food, just like our ancestors, they did not have food available 24/7, 365. They couldn't pick up the phone and have that food dropped off to them while they were sitting on a couch. So the fact is that we would be well served, if not on a daily basis, at least on a somewhat regular basis, to have periods in which we are abstaining from food. And we've already gone before and talked about all the health benefits that are linked to intermittent fasting. I mean, we know specifically that there is a greatly improved metabolic health, that it does contribute to longevity, and then most especially to mental clarity. So this is just one of those small things that we can pluck from that primitive living time period and implement today, and it doesn't cost us anything except just some intention.
So to close this out, let's talk about ways that we can integrate some of these primal practices into modern everyday life.
The best place to start with this is to just look at our daily routine. I mean, what are we doing on a day-to-day basis as far as our diet, our exercise, our schedule is concerned? I mean, we just made mention of intermittent fasting. So if we're thinking about how we could set up our nutrition to mimic a primal lifestyle that's not completely primal, that's still suitable to today, one thing would be to just start to integrate that 16-8 fasting period. And then when it is time to eat, well, what are we consuming? We're going to be focused on consuming most of our foods from animal sources. If we take that approach, then it still gives us room to add in where we would like to add in. So if you are a person who, because of your preferences, still wants to have some vegetables, great. If you want to have some fruits, great. But don't make that the focal point. Put the emphasis on the protein as you always should, and then let those things be fillers. And if you want to take it a step further, you fill it in season. So when you know particular fruits that you enjoy are in season, that would be the time to consume them, not to be consuming them all year round. So just being very intentional and aware of what is in season, what's not in season, what may travel long distances to make it to your supermarket versus what is locally grown. And then obviously from an exercise perspective, integrating just 1 to 3 resistance training workouts a week that could last as little as 10 minutes and as much as 45 minutes. But the key being that these are intense workouts that are really stressing your musculature and forcing your body to make these adaptations. But knowing that you're going to have periods, downtime periods, to allow your body to recover. No different than early humans did. They had plenty of time for their bodies to recover after a hunt or after a battle or an escape from a predator. So we have to take that same type of mindset that if I'm going to engage in this stress, then I need to give my body enough time to recuperate from that stress. But in the meantime, we can still remain active. This is where going for those daily walks, where going for those runs or that light activity, which just makes you feel good and makes you know that you are keeping your body in an optimal place because you are not being sedentary, that you are being very intentional about living this modern lifestyle by implementing some of these primal practices. I think that is the key for us to live healthy.
I couldn't agree more. And I think the other important component is community and support. And I believe that who we hang around, we become like. And so if you start to take an assessment of the people that you spend the most time with, start to examine what are your eating and drinking patterns around those people. I know how important it is because we've had different seasons of different friends in our lives. And I had friends I drank alcohol with. I had friends that I ate fast food late at a diner with. And, you know, realizing that those were things that were not serving my current goals, it became important for me to find a like-hearted community. We don't have to have the same mind, but we have to have similar hearts for different things. So for me and for you now in our lifestyle, it is hanging around people that want to take care of their body, that they want to push it to the next level. They want to have a healthy future for their children. And they know that their habits are the cornerstone of that. You know, our children, more is caught than taught. And so we can teach them all the things, but if we're not actively practicing those things, it's difficult for our children to morph into something they've never experienced themselves. And so those are the types of people that we love to spend time with. We love to fellowship with. And whether it's the gym that you're a part of, the group of friends you have, the community that you live in, or just the people you decide to give your time to and spend your time with, that is such an important element in putting some of these things into practice, because doing it together, I think, is more fun, enjoyable, and motivating than not. So to recap this, you know, we hope that you took something out of this. Primal lifestyle does not mean that you have to go live in a cave. Maybe that sounds ridiculous to you, but I think in our minds, we think that it is like a walking back in time.
You don't have to go off the grid.
You can.
Corey Beth would like to go off the grid, but we're not going off the grid anytime soon.
So he thinks. I think for you, it's understanding that I think that a lot of these very simple, very logical practices are things that are actually pretty easy for us to bring into everyday life. And we encourage you just to try one of them, whether that be prioritizing animal foods or your proteins. Maybe for you, it's realizing that that cauliflower crust pizza is probably not the healthiest thing that we eat all day. It sounds that way because it's marketed that way, but it doesn't necessarily mean that it's the best choice. Outside of that, we do have some great resources, of course, over on the rest of our podcast. So be sure to check out other episodes. And come June, we are excited to announce that we are opening up some limited spots to work one-on-one with Mike and myself. We've had a lot of people reach out and they love our annual workout subscription. They love some of the memberships that we offer both in studio and online. But there are some people that want more. They want more accountability. They want more touches. And they really just want to speed up their progress as well as their results. And so we will be posting a link for you to book a call, see if that's the right fit for you, if more accountability and some individualized approaches are really what you're looking for. Thanks for joining us today on That Fitness Couple. We've got some exciting news if you're looking to transform your fitness journey. This June 1st, we're opening 4 exclusive spots for our Pure Elite one-on-one coaching program, and one of these will be offered as a full scholarship. Imagine 3 months of direct one-on-one coaching with us, Mike and Corey Beth. You'll receive personalized workouts, tailored nutrition plans, and continuous support, all designed to achieve your unique fitness goals. We're not just your coaches, we're your partners in this journey every step of the way. Are you all in? Ready to invest in yourself and see real results? If so, apply now. These 4 spots are your opportunity to get the personalized attention you've been looking for. Check the link in our show notes to apply. And remember, spaces are incredibly limited. We're looking for participants who are committed to real, lasting change. Go apply today and let's start this transformative journey together. Stay strong and inspired, and we'll catch you in the next episode.
Tomato, tomato, let's call the whole thing off.
Mixed and edited by Desmond McNeese for We Mixed It, LLC. Go to whatsoundsawesome.com.
I was about to go off topic. Just pause me.